Whale, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and we have a very special program tonight and a very special guest. Before I get to that, I want to make several points. Now, number one, there is a ruling elite that rules the West, rules really a large part of the world. They make the decisions. They hold secret meetings. They're known as the Bilderbergers. And you will not read about them in your papers because they control the media here in the United States. And David Rockefeller, who always attends, has thanked them in the past, people who control the major media, for keeping their meetings secret so that the American people wouldn't really know what was going on. The latest meeting was actually held over in Italy there, and you can go up in WorldNet Daily, WND.com, and they have an article within about the last 10 days talking about the Bilderberger meeting and who was there, because there are people who go over and get the information, but it's totally blacked out in the controlled media here in the United States. What's really so interesting about the meeting is there were two people that you might be a little surprised were there. One of them was Ralph Reed, a longtime leader of the Christian Coalition, now one of the men whose job it is to bring the Christians in line and get them to do what they're supposed to do, and that is vote for the Christian candidate for president. And, of course, they're using the Christians to push their internationalist agenda. But the people really are not Christians at all. They run two candidates, which they're doing this year. They're running John Kerry on the Democrat ticket. They're running George Bush on the Republican ticket. And whichever candidate you pick, why their candidate wins. Now, the other interesting person who was there was Senator John Edwards, who ran for the Democrat nomination. And it's the most amazing thing. As soon as he came back from the Bilderberger meeting, where he was obviously tapped by the leaders of the world who run as the vice president behind John Kerry, suddenly there is a tremendous groundswell of support for John Edwards for the number two slot on the Democrat ticket. And if you read the papers and the New York Times and all the other establishment publications owned by these very wealthy and powerful people, you will find the groundswell of support for Senator John Edwards. Is that just coincidence? I don't think so. I think that they pick our presidential candidates. They pick the vice presidential candidates. Obviously, John Edwards was tapped when he went over to Italy. The other thing is, of course, I think we should all be very, very concerned about what's going on in Saudi Arabia by the death of this American over there and the killing of other Americans. But even more than that, the fact that our government has called all of the Americans living in Saudi Arabia to leave. If the Americans and the British technicians leave, why the Saudi regime will fall. And I think that we are pushing the Saudi regime. I believe that our intent is to topple the Saudi regime, and our forces then will have to move in. We'll have no alternative. We can't have this Saudi regime and its nuclear, because they have about 100 nuclear tip missiles over there, and you're not hearing about it, but they have, these are intermediate range missiles, they've got, of course, the nuclear warheads from Pakistan. They've got the missiles themselves, probably for either North Korea or China. And so we will have to move our forces in if indeed Saudi does begin to implode from within. A number of very knowledgeable people I've been in touch with and reading what they're saying. I mean, these are the people who really know what's going on, believe, as I do, that Saudi Arabia is about to topple. And with that will come a massive expansion of the war in the Middle East. May the Lord help us. Well, with that as the background, let me introduce our special guest this evening. His name is Dave Emery. He's been with us many times before. And Dave does full-time, as far as I can tell, just researching what's going on in the world. He has his own radio programs. He's going to be speaking here in Santa Cruz tomorrow evening down at the Loudoun Nelson Center. He's going to be talking, and you're going to hear this evening his views on the Palestinian-Israeli problem of the conflict. These are not necessarily my views, but I want you to hear what he has to say. So without further ado, Dave, thank you so very much for being with us this evening.
It's a pleasure, as always, Stan. One thing I did want to correct, I'd prefer not to talk about the Israeli-Palestinian
question. Oh, all right, fine.
Because I'm lecturing about that in Santa Cruz tomorrow.
All right, fine. Then what did you want to talk about?
Well, you know what? We could talk about all kinds of things. I mean, I was thinking that in keeping with sort of the introductory theme of your show, the politics of illusion, I thought two possibilities. One might be to talk about Ronald Reagan and the difference between the perception of Reagan and what actually took place. Under Reagan's administration, my personal feeling is Reagan was primarily a front and a puppet. I don't think that Reagan really fully understood a lot of what was going on behind him. I particularly don't think he understood George Herbert Walker Bush, who was his vice president, and I believe the man was really running the country. Another thing which we might talk about, since the 10th anniversary of the beginning of this absolutely unfortunate affair, and that is the O.J. Simpson case, and the difference between the popular perception and what actually took place.
All right, fine. I would like to talk about that because, in fact, I think that is really one of the most important issues of our time. If we've really understood what this was really all about, what other instances there have been? Let's talk a little bit about your views on O.J., and I'll give you my views on O.J., but for the background for our listeners, let me put it this way. What other instances there been where they've just shut down the media, totally given up their advertisement, and ABC, CBS, and NBC, you know, 6 or 8 hours a day showed a court trial? Why would they do that? Why were they focusing our attention on this trial day after day after day? And we could see what was going on there. This was all what everybody was talking about. And it was a very divisive issue because I don't know any black who believes that O.J. Simpson was guilty. I don't know very, very few whites who believe he was innocent. I believe that this was staged for a very, very specific purpose. That was to create a racial division in our society, and they really did it. So with that, and of course, I cannot believe that any prosecutor, any lawyer who has ever prosecuted a case, would ask O.J. Simpson to put on those gloves if they didn't know that they would fit him. Why would you ask him to try to put on the gloves if there'd be any question at all that they weren't his gloves? In other words, he would have difficulty getting them on. When you ask a question, you know the answer ahead of time. These were not amateurs. These were people who knew what they were doing. It was almost as if they threw the case. With that as a background, let's get your idea on this.
Well, Dr. Singh, you know, it's funny because, you know, there are any number of things that you and I disagree about. On the other hand, one of the things I really enjoy about appearing on your program is that you not only ask questions that need to be asked, and again, there are many things, you know, on which you and I disagree about, but, you know, it's really important for people to be able to disagree respectfully and sympathetically. Just that level of civility is so missing in this society, and it's just really refreshing to deal with someone such as yourself, Dr. Stan, who will give somebody free rein, even when they disagree with some of their things. But beyond that, you blow me away regularly with some of your insights and the extent to which those things not only dovetail with my own views, but you often, and then the O.J. case sounds like a perfect example of that, you present me with one of the very few forums in which I can talk about this stuff freely without the firestorm of hatred and vituperation coming my way. You know, tomorrow I'm going to be talking about the Israeli-Palestinian question. By the way, that's going to be in the Loudoun Nelson Center on Center Street in Santa Cruz. It'll be at 7 p.m. And the book Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile will be available because I've printed some of those up. So if listeners who've heard about that in past programs want to get a hold of that, tomorrow night, 7 p.m., Loudoun Nelson Community Center, I'll be there. The book will be there. But the Israeli
Palestinian... Before you go on, that is a very important book. Have you simply pulled it down off your internet site, or is it going to be in a soft cover, or is it going to be just a mimeograph?
It's been copied and put in a spiral binder, because the book is available for download for free on the internet, but there's still a lot of people that don't have the online capabilities to do that yet, because it does take some time.
Okay, I think that, let me just mention to our listeners, that's a very, very important book. So go ahead, without further ado, you pick the story up from there.
It is a very important book, but the Israeli-Palestinian question is one that I think it's important to talk about, yet I'll be absolutely frank, Dr. Stan, it's a lecture, and I'll be giving this in several places, that I approach with some degree of hesitation, because other than the O.J. Simpson case, I have never seen a question where people are so energized and so uninformed about what's actually going on, but so absolutely vicious in terms of the reaction that they have if you don't absolutely agree with them. There's a dynamic that I like to introduce, and that's a dynamic of information versus confirmation. What I try to do on my program and in any appearances, such as what I'm doing on your show, is to give people information, to inform them. But so many people are not interested in information. They're interested in confirmation of their beliefs, their prejudices, their suspicions. And if you give them information, if you try to enlighten them, they often will react absolutely viciously. And I have never seen two cases where people are more polarized, more vituperative, more bitter, and not only that, but just more hair-triggered, to coin a term, where they're just absolutely cocked and ready to go on you if you say something that doesn't agree with their presuppositions.
Well, Dave, did you ever think that our minds are controlled, that we are manipulated, that ideas are implanted in our reality and they become then a source of emotional response? And I believe that the people who control the media control our reality, and if we're black, why, at least in the case of the O.J. Simpson situation, why we would feel he was innocent. If we were white, we would feel he was guilty. Mm-hmm. The same thing would be true as far as the Palestinian-Arab situation. If you're a liberal, why, you're in favor of the Palestinians, the oppressed Palestinians. If you're conservative and probably coming from a Christian point of view, you would be in favor of Israelis. And I would like to suggest that both sides are being manipulated by exactly the same people. After all, who's supplying weapons and money to the Palestinians? Why, the United States. Who's supplying money and weapons to the Israelis? Why, the United States. What's wrong with this scenario? Well, anyway, but let's get back to the O.J. Simpson, because I wish I could be down there tomorrow to hear your remarks on the Palestinian situation. Maybe we could do that as another program.
Yeah, we can we can certainly put that on the agenda for a future appearance. It's not an easy thing to talk about, but, you know, again, by way of introduction, I am absolutely in accord with your views on the O.J. case. It may be that some of the information that I'm about to develop, there may be some things you disagree with, or as I suspect, probably some things that not even you are fully aware of. But the O.J. case was, in my considered opinion, a psyop. It was a psychological operation. It was a media event that was presented to us in a fashion to produce a predetermined response. And that response was evil. I would call it unholy. It was meant to create bitterness. It was meant to create hatred between blacks and whites. It was meant to a certain extent, I think, to create hatred between men and women. It was made to create suspicion of our judicial system. And our judicial system was subverted in the O.J. Simpson case. Legal precedents were set that I think very few people are actually aware of. I personally am not all that worried about the Patriot Act, and there are some aspects of it, such as librarians having to inform the federal authorities about what books people are reading, that it almost seemed to me, to coin a term, Dr. Stan, pornographically Orwellian in their scope. I wonder if it wasn't even designed to fail. But so many legal precedents, or really they would be better termed illegal precedents, were set in the O.J. Simpson case. And as you certainly know, law is built, Anglo-Saxon legal principle is built on a system of precedent. Judicial decisions are made on the basis of legal precedent. And there was some legal precedent set in the O.J. Simpson case that would make the hair stand on any intelligent person's head. But the problem is, and this goes right back to the sort of core theme of your program, Dr. Stan, which is that the media didn't tell us what was actually going on. They in the O.J. Simpson case, what the American people were basically handed was the viewpoint of one man, and that is Mark Furman. Mark Furman, of course, was an LAPD detective. He was also the detective who discovered much of the, quote, evidence, unquote, please note my selection of words, quote, evidence, unquote, in the O.J. case. He also was the detective who conducted the altogether illegal search of O.J.'s property that turned up a lot of this evidence. And the viewpoint of Mark Furman is not at all representative of the viewpoint of reality. There's so much with regard to the O.J. Simpson case. One of the problems with the way this was approached was that basically the media did not present us with the facts. I don't think there has ever been a greater corruption of cognitive reality by the American media than there was with regard to the O.J. Simpson case. Maybe some of our assassinations, such as the JFK assassination and others. But the fact of the matter is, the verifiable evidence in the O.J. Simpson case was nothing. Nothing whatsoever like what the public was told. Most of the public's perception of the case stemmed not only from what Mark Furman had to say, because basically he was in charge of the, quote, investigation, unquote, but it was also determined by a very strange media event in which a car going very slowly, carrying O.J. Simpson, precipitated this quote, chase, unquote. And let's just say if that event, that famous Friday evening motorcade, I think would be a better way of putting it, if that's a chase, then I'm a hound dog. That was no chase. That was Al Cowlings driving very slowly with O.J. Simpson, whom Al Cowlings claims was threatening to kill himself. Now, we don't have anybody else's word but Al Cowlings. O.J. did have a gun and a disguise and a passport and a fair amount of cash on hand. But what people didn't get told, first of all, the interesting thing, one of the many interesting things about that so-called car chase was that, first of all, Al Cowlings really presented the view that the public held. And Al Cowlings, a longtime friend of O.J. Simpson's, a teammate of O.J. Simpson's at USC, first of all, when they were playing college ball, on the Buffalo Bills, which was the first team O.J. played for, and later, both Al Cowlings and O.J. Simpson concluded their careers on the San Francisco 49ers. Dr. Stan, I'm going to ask a favor. If I forget to bring up the 49ers, the issue of the NFL and organized crime, and a very interesting thing that took place up here on KGO Radio, remind me of Edward DeBartolo, the owner of the San Francisco 49ers at that time, because there's a very important piece of information that the judges might get lost in the shuffle. But Al Cowlings, first of all, Al Cowlings, along with Robert Kardashian, longtime friend of O.J.'s, one of the attorneys who represented him for quite some time, were both being investigated by a grand jury in connection with the largest sports betting ring in California, or even Western U.S. history. Al Cowlings also faced some 46 different indictments in relation to a cocaine case. According to an article published in the Boston Herald, he was a driver and sometime bodyguard for a guy named Joey Ippolito, who had succeeded Meyer Lansky, basically had subsumed head of Meyer Lansky's operations in the greater Los Angeles area. So Al Cowlings, in terms of his credibility and integrity as a witness, is shall we say, a questionable individual. Yet the perception of what was taking place in that car at that time comes from Al Cowlings. And I'll simply leave it to your judgment, Dr. Stan, and to the judgment of your listeners. Would you view the statements of an individual like that, with a background like that, as beyond reproach? Well, I think the answer suggests itself very clearly. Another thing, one of the things that the media did so horribly in the O.J. Simpson case was to completely break up reality. If one pictures a mirror, for example, like a mirror with a picture, you know, a piece of glass, a mirror with an engraving on it, and those things do exist, if you take that and then smash it into little pieces, and then just take little pieces and reassemble them to create the image that one wants, that's what the media did in the O.J. Simpson case. And the difference between what can be verifiably recorded as having happened and what the media told us are two entirely different things. And here's the music fading in the background. One of the questions that people can ask themselves while we take a little break here is why that car, quote, chase, unquote, was never entered into evidence by the prosecution in the criminal case or the plaintiffs in the civil case, because it wasn't. And yet that was the thing that convinced everybody, and yet it was never brought into evidence. That's a really good question for people to ponder while we take a little break here.
All right, we'll be back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Dave Emery, and we're talking about the O.J. Simpson case. Now, for the person out there, most people have very, very firm views on O.J. Simpson. And before the hour is over, I'm going to tell you why I believe that most people's views are wrong. But let's go ahead, and let me just preface my remarks that we put together a four-tape set on O.J. Simpson. There are 4 one-hour interviews I did with various people. One man wrote about the timeline of the O.J. Simpson case, and he said that, you know, if you follow the timeline very, very carefully, there's no way Simpson could have done it. One author says that they framed a guilty man. In other words, there was no question in his mind that O.J. Simpson was guilty. There were people who'd seen him, driving, or at least a man who looked very much like O.J. Simpson, driving a white Bronco from the murder scene back to his the place where he lived. But that couldn't be entered into evidence because the woman who had given that testimony, would have given the testimony, had already sold her story to a major magazine. So it couldn't be entered into evidence. A third person had worked getting information from the police, who were very concerned because they were putting in faulty evidence. In other words, they were actually staging evidence to convict O.J. Simpson. They were planting evidence that really was totally fraudulent. And the fourth is really the most intriguing book. But I'll tell you about that perhaps a little later in the story. Go ahead. Why don't you pick it up from there, Dave?
Well, I tell you, another of the challenges with your program, Dr. Stan, is I've always tempted to jump track. Let me just guess about a couple of the authors. Was the timeline, was that Donald Freed by
right,
any chance?
Right, right, right.
Talking about killing Tom. I've interviewed him a number of times on my program as well. I don't know if one of the authors that you... interviewed, there was a really important book by a wonderful author that was completely deep six. It was called Legacy of Deception by an author named Steven Singular. He had written a book about the murder of Alan Berg, the Denver talk show host who was killed by the Aryan Nation. And he was, and that movie was later made into the Oliver Stone film, Talk to Death. Was it Talk to Death? No, that was the book. It was Talk Radio. Was the movie. The book that he wrote about the Alan Berg case was Talk to Death. But Steven Singular was contacted by a source within the LA legal system who specifically contacted him because of his work on the murder of Alan Berg. And what he told Steven Singular was that basically O.J. was being framed, but that there were neo-Nazi elements who'd worked their way into the LAPD, the LA legal system. And as he put it, neo-Nazis are not just on the fringes of society anymore. They're deep inside the system and are doing a great deal of harm. Steven Singular then, acting on tips from his unnamed source, who would have lost his job, determined absolutely that there was a frame-up of O.J. Simpson, that there was a very, very firm exculpatory evidence, but that not only the prosecution worked against this, but that the defense itself was fixed. And he specifically approached Chris Darden, one of the attorneys, one of the two African-American attorneys for O.J. Simpson, and pointed up the evidence about the amount of EDTA, that's a preservative, that was found within the blood sample on the back gate of the Rockingham residence.
And, of course, yeah, that's one of the men I interviewed. And, of course, you do not have EDTA in fresh blood. This is in preserved blood. This is the blood specimen they took from O.J. Simpson. And then they used that blood to put it on the gate to plant evidence to convict him of murder. We'll be right back in a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course all of our stations are back with us now, and we've just been talking a little bit about the 4-tape set we have on O.J. Simpson. I think it's one of the most important tape sets we have. Very, very few people really want to think about this, and yet you have to think about it, because this was how they discovered they could totally control the reality of most Americans. We talked about four books, and of course, I find that Dave has read all of the books, and probably has interviewed most of the same authors I have. One of them is a book called Timeline, simply going into the background that if you study the timeline, as the prosecution put it out, it couldn't have been that way. A man named Steven Singular, who was a well-known author, and he was contacted by someone on the police force who said, you know, they were planting evidence. They were planting evidence to convict O.J., and the evidence was not valid. And, of course, there was one other book that went into the background of the man who was firmly convinced that O.J. was guilty, but he said that they had framed a guilty man. That was a wonderful term, that framed a guilty man. In other words, there was so much evidence there that had been totally fraudulent, but he was firmly convinced that O.J. was guilty. And, you know, the fellow sitting next to him was a black reporter. He was firmly convinced O.J. was innocent. So here we see the divide, and that's what it was really all about. They were playing games with our mind. They did a wonderful job of turning black against white and white against black. So you pick it up from there, Dave.
One of those authors was Steven Singular.
Right.
Dr. Stan, you're great. I mean, nobody, I talk about, they say, did you ever read a book called Legacy of Deception? The book was suppressed, by the way, because it didn't dovetail with the official version, and Steven Singular's career was horribly damaged. I believe it also contributed materially to his divorce. When I interviewed Steven Singular, he was so depressed about the lack of access that he'd had. His publisher tried to suppress the book. Interviewers treated him like he was nuts. And he's a really good human being and a dedicated reporter. He, by the way, his father had fought in World War II and had been captured by the Germans and had been very moved at some of what he saw when he was a POW, and had taught Steven Singular a great deal about the Holocaust and about fascism. And that was one of the things that spurred Steven Singular's interest in the murder of Alan Berg. And the night of the announcement of the verdict in the Sybil case, I spoke with Steven Singular, and he was very depressed and very angry at the media orgy that was taking place. And he said, well, now I know how the Holocaust could happen. Now I know how reality can be completely perverted by the media and how people can be made to believe in something that's utterly false and demonstrably false. He was eloquently depressed, to coin a term. But anyway, you never cease to amaze me, Dr. Stan. I've been mining the political ores for many, many years, and almost nobody even knows about the book, and yet you're right on time. And so, once again, kudos. There was so much evidence in the O.J. Simpson case that the public did not get told about. I was convinced from the beginning that O.J. was innocent, simply because as a blue-collar worker, and among the many things I've done, I've been a short-order cook, and short-order cooks know about cuts, and they know about knives, and they know about blood, and there was simply no way, in my considered opinion, that one man with an edged weapon could kill two people in that time, and do it in such a manner. I mean, they're both Nicole and Ron were virtually exsanguinated. There was blood all over the place. And yet he didn't have a mark on him except for a couple of small cuts on his hands. Nobody heard anything. There was no blood to speak of on his person. And in circumstances like that, both Ron and Nicole would have been screaming bloody murder. It was a very quiet neighborhood that Nicole lived in. The camera angles of the shots of the bloody walkway and the bloody yard made it appear as though there was a huge distance between the front gate and the porch of Nicole's place. Actually, it was only about 8 feet. That was due to the camera angle. But there's simply no way that a struggle of that magnitude could have taken place without anybody hearing it, without Nicole getting off a scream. It's one of the indications that a team has to have committed that killing. But I recall when I was cooking on a Friday night dinner rush, and we were out of Denver mix. And as any short order cook knows, a Denver omelet, you have to dice up. You get diced bell peppers, diced onions, and diced ham, and you toss it into the omelet, and you cook it on up, and you feed it on out. We were out of Denver mix, and I was dicing bell peppers on the line because we were in the middle of a busy dinner rush, and I sliced my thumb. I didn't slice it all the way through, but I just put a nice cut on it, and that bled. I mean, that bled so much, and it was blood all over. It was just a tiny little cut. But there's adrenaline. You're working hard. You're, as you know, as a doctor, Dr. Stan, your heart's pumping. Your system's putting adrenaline into your system. And there's a lot of bleeding that takes place. And that was nothing compared to the slaughter that took place on June 12th, 1994. So right away, I was suspicious. I said, there's no way one guy with a knife commits a crime like that. Nobody hears anything. Nobody sees anything. He flies through the air, materializes 20 miles away, and there's not a mark on him.
We'll be back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here, and certainly one of our favorite guests, Dave Emery, and we're talking about the O.J. Simpson trial. And one of the things that really convinced me, you know, obviously the person who did this knew exactly what they were doing. There were several transfers of marks, very superficial on the neck, and then there was a stab through the right flank, right into the aorta or the vena cava, where, of course, Ron Goldman exsanguinated to death almost on the point. Now, that is the sort of thrust you would see from somebody who was trained by special forces, trained by one of our assassin teams. And we do train assassins here. I've talked to people who worked in the CIA who were trained as assassins. They know exactly how to do it. But I don't think O.J. Simpson had any tendencies along that line. I don't think he would have known how to have done it. Not only that, there was DNA under Nicole Simpson's fingernails that didn't belong to her husband, O.J., but that was never brought out. That, of course, everything was done to suppress the really important parts of the story. And the question is, why did the media draw our attention to us and then suppress so much that was important? So pick up the story there.
Yes, indeed, Dr. Stan. There were at least two different, the blood of two different people on the crime scene that didn't belong to either O.J. or the victims, but that question was never asked. There was a denim jacket, a male denim jacket, found inside of Nicole's house. The owner was never determined. Fingerprints had been wiped off the doorknob to Nicole's place, as well as the telephone. How that happened has never been determined. With regard to the forensic evidence, just some of the phony evidence, we've noted that there isn't EDTA in human blood. The blood sample on the back gate, and supposedly O.J. had left via the back. But crime scene photographs were presented that clearly showed no blood stains on the back gate after the crime. In the civil case, LAPD personnel who had been called by the prosecutor, by the plaintiffs, said, well, the photographs were just such low quality that you couldn't see the blood stain, which is completely insane. As you know, Dr. Stan, the quality of the photographs by a forensic laboratory are very good indeed. A blood stain is going to show up. But there was no blood when they took the pictures. Then blood laced with high levels of EDTA appears. And then that preservative does not exist in those quantities in human blood. It would kill the person whose blood it had been. The photos of the front yard had been badly doctored. It turned out there was a set of bloody footprints going out the front gate. O.J. supposedly left by the back with the Akita dog.
Hold that thought right there just for a moment. Okay, Dr. Stan, and of course Dave Emery is talking about the fact that there was doctoring of the films. There were forensic films that were taken. Supposedly O.J. had gone out the back gate, but the initial films didn't show any blood there, and then later on the blood mysteriously appears after the crime investigation has gone on. In other words, somebody planted the blood there, and then there was footprints showing that whoever had committed the crime had gone out the front gate. So pick up the story from there.
The photographs of the front part of Nicole's place had been cropped specifically. These photographs had been cropped in the presentation at the criminal trial to eliminate the pictures of the bloody footprints with the Akita's bloody paw prints following the person out the front gate. Well, O.J. supposedly left by the back. Who's leaving by the front? Leaving bloody footprints, and the Akita leaving bloody paw prints. That was Nicole's dog following the footprints. There were all kinds of other travesties of evidence.
Well, I think one of the most important ones is that they got O.J.'s socks. They made him take off his socks. They were placed in evidence. And then, of course, they found blood. They found his blood. It was his blood and Nicole's blood, I've forgotten, on the socks. But it was on both sides of the socks. Now, you know, you couldn't get it on both sides of the socks in the same location unless it was poured on after the socks were in evidence. And, of course, that blood also had the EDTA in it or something of the sort. Anyway, this was very, very obvious evidence that, you know, this had been planted. In other words, the police had falsified the evidence to convict, whether you think he was guilty or innocent, why they had falsified the evidence. And this is done in police cases. How many innocent people are in prison today or have been executed because of police officers who are going to protect the public by putting evidence out that would convict innocent people? And I believe that Mark Furman, my personal belief, all the evidence would suggest that Mark Furman at least knew that they were planting evidence.
Oh, we'll get to Mark Furman in a couple of minutes. He is one of the Furman's behavior is probably the most interesting aspect of the case, and the extent to which the information about Mark Furman was absolutely blocked from public view is one of the most scandalous aspects of the case. And again, when people look at something like that, they tend to inherently trust the media to tell them the truth, and they trust the judicial system, both the police and the courts, to do what they're supposed to do, which is to make an objective assessment of the evidence and to determine what is going on. With regard to the sock, Dr. Stan, there was a guy with a camcorder who was videotaping the scene, and they very obviously did not see the socks very obviously didn't show in O.J.'s bedroom. When this was brought out in the criminal trial, the prosecution said, well, the timer on the video recorder was off by a full 24 hours. Well, that's childish. And the guy who was operating the camera said, nope, there were no socks there when I made the film. Not only was there EDTA in the sample of blood, but the blood was in one giant glob that, as you noted quite correctly, Dr. Stan, was on the side of one sock and it soaked through to the other side, which can't happen if there's a leg in it. Not only that, but listeners should maybe make an experiment. Take one of those little pans that you use when you're painting a room, you know, that you roll up. The brush, or just take a cookie pan and put some water in it, or some water with some food coloring, and then put on a pair of old sneakers, or just a pair of socks. Step in the pan and see how the water splatters, the liquid splatters. It's not going to come up in one great big glob, bloop, up on the side of the sock. It's going to scatter. It's going to scatter out in the front of the pan, and any liquid that gets on the foot of the sock is going to be spread around. It's not going to be in one big glob that all adheres. Coheres to the side and it together and jumps to the side of the sock. I mean, it just,
well, both sides of the sock.
Yeah, it will then soaks through the person's leg. I mean, it is amazing. Now, Detective Van Adder, rather, one of Furman's fellow detectives. And one of the things that took place in the case was that the blue line took place. That a lot of cops, in order to back up Mark Furman, they basically made sure that the verdict was predetermined. Detective Van Adder has stated in his book about the O.J. case that for a week after the killings, he was riding around with the blood sample of both O.J. Simpson and both victims. Now, these had been checked into evidence. What was the detective riding around with blood samples of both victims and the alleged perpetrator a week after the case? I mean, there's no credible explanation for that except that he was planting evidence. Detective Kelly Muldorfer, an LAPD detective, testified in the criminal case that when she examined O.J.'s car, there was no blood in the car. A guy, and this is interesting in and of itself, a guy who broke into that car while it was in police custody testified that there was no blood in the car. And yet there was blood found in the car afterward. Some of the most interesting aspects of the O.J. case to me concern Mark Furman, his background, among the pieces of information that was suppressed, and this is what ultimately I think brought Stephen Singular into the case, courtesy of his contact within the judicial system. But Mark Furman was known to have very strong white supremacist views. He was, according to information in the LAPD personnel files, he was head of a white supremacist group within the LAPD called WASP, which was an acronym for White Anglo-Saxon Policemen. This information was not admitted into evidence in the trial because Lance Ito would not allow it to be introduced into evidence. Lance Ito's wife, a woman named York, was the highest-ranking female member of the Los Angeles Police Department, and she was Mark Furman's watch commander. She had had to discipline Mark Furman when he had written KKK on January 15th, the Martin Luther King holiday.
And, of course, the thing was that Ito, because of his relationship with his wife, who was, of course, the supervisor of Mark Furman, should have recused himself from the case, but he wanted the notoriety.
Absolutely.
When are you ever going to see the dancing Itos on Jay Leno if you're not, of course, the judge on this most famous of all cases? So they had both the defense and the prosecution, could compromise him because he'd already compromised himself.
It is an amazing travesty of justice. Another interesting aspect of Mark Furman's background is that a number of detectives from the West LAPD station said that Mark Furman had been boasting all around the West LAPD station of having had an affair with Nicole. In an interest to the FCC and to your listeners, I won't repeat exactly what he said, but he implied in no uncertain terms that he had had a sexual relationship with Nicole. Now, whether he actually did bed Nicole or whether that was just locker room BS is immaterial under the circumstances. Marcia Clark would not allow that. Three deputy district attorneys from Los Angeles put that information in a letter to Marcia Clark. Now, as you know, Dr. Stan, deputy DAs, particularly one of them, a woman named Lucian Coleman, was a 17-year veteran of the DA's office. Assistant DAs don't help the defense in a capital murder case, and yet they did this time because they knew that Furman was tainted and that he was not an objective observer. And again, here you have the lead detective in the case having expressed, either had an affair with or expressing romantic interest in the victim. He then conducts an illegal search of the alleged perpetrator's property and comes up with the quote, evidence, unquote. That is very damning indeed. Furthermore, there's an excellent book called Blood Oath by Stephen Wirth and Carl Jaspers, which develops the white supremacist connection to this very strange case. It maintains that the actual strike team was done by a group of white supremacists, an elite group who called themselves CAUSE, standing for Christian Aryan Underground Special Enforcers. But that, as you indicated, Dr. Stan, all of them had intelligence, military, and law enforcement backgrounds, and that they had conducted a very sophisticated operation. They had ex-Green Beret in the execution team. So these were highly skilled people with military intelligence and police skills who knew how to subvert the system. And they also, Stephen Wirth and Carl Jasper, said that they had a contact within the LAPD who was part of their team, whom he referred to as codename Dark German. Now, what does that rhyme with? Obviously, it rhymes with Mark Furman. One of the most interesting aspects of the case, and again, in terms of assessing the horrible performance of the media in this case, Mark Furman, whom again had expressed sexual interest, romantic interest in the victim, Mark Furman, who was head of a white supremacist group within LAPD, Mark Furman, whose watch commander was Judge Ito's wife. By the way, O.J. and Nicole had been getting written and telephone death threats from white supremacist groups. Both the FBI and LAPD had warned both of them about this. This is actually in Cato Kalin's book. And then, in the pretrial hearing, when Marcia Clark asked Mark Furman where he was and what he was doing the night of the killings, June 12, 1994, Mark Furman lied on the stand. He said he was at a Police Protective League barbecue in La Quinta, California, that in fact had taken place a day earlier, or maybe it was a day later. Point is, he lied on the stand during the pretrial hearing about where he was and what he was doing the night of the killing. I've talked to legal professionals who've voiced the opinion that certainly would have been enough for a grand jury to indict Mark Furman for murder. That combined evidence, the fact that he was had expressed interest in Nicole, the fact that he was head of a white supremacist group, that the victim had been getting telephone death threats from white supremacist groups, including warnings that had been communicated through the LAPD, the fact that Furman lied on the stand about where he was and what he was doing the night of the killing, the fact that Furman had conducted the illegal search of O.J. Simpson's place in order to come up with the, quote, evidence, unquote, that that would certainly have been enough for a grand jury to indict O.J.
And indict Mark Furman.
Excuse me, Mark Furman, right. Yeah, excuse me. And that it might have been enough for a criminal jury to convict him on the basis of the consciousness of guilt principle of law, where the fact that he lied on the stand about what he was, where he was and what he was doing might have led to a conviction under certain circumstances. But in any event, all of this is stuff that the public just didn't get told. Some of it appeared in little articles here or little books there, but it was an astounding travesty of justice.
Well, let me just intercede. This was far more detailed even than you're making out. No sooner was this case announced, and of course the O.J. is presented as the prime suspect, than O.J.'s face appears on the front page of Time magazine.
Uh-huh.
But of course, it's not O.J.'s face. It's a very dark and sinister-looking black man, very dark skins. Now, if anybody's ever seen O.J. Simpson, you know he's got very light skin. So why would Time magazine put a very dark-skinned image of there on the front page of Time? In other words, they had to darken that intentionally to give the impression. See, they're playing games with the minds of the American people. And, of course, this was to be, here's a black man who killed his white wife. That was really the message of that Time magazine front page. I mean, why, first of all, front page of Time magazine, very important place. So there is O.J., very, very dark skin. Obviously, it has been touched up intentionally to create that impression in the minds of the American people. Here's this black man. Yeah. So this is the whole racial tone of this whole thing. We're drawing close to the end of this hour, and we'll be losing some of our listeners. And so the book that Dave was just talking about, I've interviewed the author, and we have a 4-tape set on O.J., and it includes my interview with the author of the book, who was contacted by at least a man who claimed he was part of this hit team, if this is the same book I'm thinking of, and talked about, of course, their contact in the within the police force, and explained to him it was all designed to create a race war. And, of course, but what was so interesting, from my point of view, was about a year ago now, I was at a conference, and we always set up a table, and I had my one copy of my 4-tape set on O.J., and a very, very attractive black woman came up, and she picked it up, and she's looking at it, and there was nobody else there, so I thought I'd just strike up a conversation with her. And I said, you know, I think that's one of my most important tape sets, but nobody's interested in the O.J. tragedy today. Everybody wants to forget it. And then I commented, but you know, it was really a very important issue because they were trying to create a race war. And yep. She looked at me sort of startled and she said, well, why do you say that? And I said, well, because every white person I know believes that O.J. was guilty. Every black person believes he was innocent. And she says, that's exactly true. She said, you know, I'm black and every black person I know believes that O.J. was framed, that he was innocent. That is, except for my brother. And my brother, of course, he was raised among whites, so he thinks like white people. And because he thinks like white people, why he was convinced that O.J. was guilty. Until about a month ago, when he called me, he called me at 2:00 in the morning. Of course, she lived on the East Coast and he lived on the West Coast. And she said, he called me to tell me that one of his friends who was with Special Forces had told him, oh, don't you know, that was a Special Forces operation. Of course, O.J. was innocent. I mean, he was set up. We set him up. We laid all the evidence out there pointing right to him. And so her brother, her black brother, was telling her that she was right, that he was wrong, that this was a Special Forces operation. It had to be. It had to be much larger than simply a group of white supremacists, although they may have used that. But you don't get the darkened picture on the front page of Time magazine. You don't get all the media to play that day after day after day after day. You don't get trained prosecutors to ask O.J. to put on the gloves with a phrase in the back of the mind, if the gloves don't fit, you've got to acquit. I mean, that was really one of the greatest spectacles of all time, and the American people have to understand how they manipulate our minds, how they focus our attention on certain specific issues, and how, of course, they can make us hate the Iraqis, they can make us hate the Muslims, they can make us hate the blacks, and they can make the blacks hate the whites, they can make us all hate the Hispanics. They're really wonderful about how they can divide, because when you divide, you can conquer.
Yeah, Dr. Stan, by the way, the white supremacist thesis and the intelligence community thesis are not mutually exclusive, because there are entire sections of the intelligence community that are under control of what I call an underground Reich. One of the mistakes that we made when we took in, at least that I think a lot of the people in our government made a mistake. Some of them were doing just what they wanted to do. But when we took in these people like Heinrich Mueller, and we've talked about that in past shows, Martin Bormann, the Galen spy outfit, we took all these Nazis and grafted them into our country, and there were powerful industrialists and financiers in our country who were already pro-Nazi, including Bush's ancestors. George Herbert Walker, his great-grandfather, and Prescott Bush Sr., his father, worked with Nazi industry. They helped with the post-World War II disposition of Nazi funds. When we took those people in, we were making, I would believe, almost literally a bargain with the devil.
Well, I believe that we are fighting the devil, but we can't fight him ourselves in our own strength, but I believe there really are demonic forces out there. So go ahead, pick that up. One question I really want to ask you, do you have any evidence that Heinrich Mueller ever came to the United States?
I don't. I don't have any evidence that he ever came to the U.S. There is a book out by an author named Douglas, I believe his first name is Gregory, that maintains that he did.
Right. We carried the book, but I just questioned whether you had any specific evidence on that, other than the book by Gregory Douglas.
No, I have it, and I can't speak yay or nay for the information in his book. I'm not casting aspersions on him, but one of the things that the Mueller outfit, any good intelligence outfit, is excellent at creating disinformation, and the best way you do it is to put out a story that's maybe 80% true. 80% is bedrock fact, and then you work in just enough BS that you can prove to be BS, and then it discredits all the good stuff by association.
So they are so much more clever. And, of course, since they can control the media, they can control our reality.
Oh, and with the OJ case, there are a lot of indications of involvement of some elements of the intelligence community. Some of the forensics people brought in were people who'd worked in the past for the House Select Committee on Assassinations, endorsing the untenable single bullet theory and the JFK assassination. As a physician, Dr. Stan, that one must be a source of particularly strong and bitter amusement to you. I mean, it's just absolutely ridiculous.
Well, not even more ridiculous. I actually have an interview with Dr. Crenshaw, who was in the Parkland Hospital when they brought Governor Connally in, and he had, of course, had the bullet after magic bullet went through President Kennedy. It went through Connally's chest, went through his right wrist, left all sorts of bullet fragments, which Dr. Crenshaw described, and went into Governor Connally's left thigh, from the right wrist to the left thigh, left bullet fragments there, and of course many of them were removed in the surgery. They were debriding the wounds, but that magic bullet then reconstituted itself and miraculously got completely covered with lead, so there were really hardly any markings on it at all, and was found then lying on the gurney there in the Parkland Hospital right next to Governor Connally. Now, I could believe maybe a bullet could do flip-flops, but how would it reconstitute itself? It truly was a magic bullet.
Oh, yes. Plus, it executed several sharp turns in midair without being acted upon by another object, in contravention of the law of inertia. But, you know, these are, of course, very small points. I'm being facetious. But another interesting thing about the OJ case, some of the doctoring of some of the photographic evidence was done by the Rochester Institute of Technology at the University of Rochester, which has a long-standing relationship with the Central Intelligence Agency. People remember the photos that appeared in the National Enquirer. This is one of the tabloids that disseminates a lot of information that reaches a lot of people. You know, people see it waiting online at the supermarket or at the pharmacy. And a lot of people don't realize the background of the National Enquirer. It was founded by a guy named Generoso Pope, who was a quote-unquote CIA psychological warfare officer. People I know in the intelligence community whom I respect say flat out, they allege flat out, we'll cover our butts here, that the National Enquirer is run by the Central Intelligence Agency. It is used, they do have very good sources of information. If they want to destroy a celebrity, they find out who's sleeping with who, who's doing drugs, who's abusing their spouse, who's drinking too much, and they use it to attack people. They also invent information to destroy people because they have a tremendous amount of money and they have some of the best tort lawyers in the world, and they will drag you out into a 15-year litigation, take all your time, take all your money, impose incredible stress on your system. You won't be able to work. And even if you win the case 15 years later, you may not get that much in damages and your whole life has been ruined. So bearing in mind the background of the National Enquirer and Generoso Pope and the role that that played in the O.J. Simpson case, that was a tremendous vehicle for disinformation. One of the scariest aspects of the case to me is the person who was in charge of the crime scene.
Well, you know, I'm going to have to just interrupt you because we're going to have to say goodbye to our listeners in the Great Northwest. We're going to lose five of our stations, but then we'll get back to this. And of course, if you're up there listening to us there in the Seattle area, or in the Spokane area, why, we do have an excellent four-tape set. Of course, you can get the full 2 hours of this on our internet program at RadioLiberty.com, or if you have shortwave, you can get the second hour at 7.535. That's 7.535 megahertz. And if you don't have either one of them, shame on you. But we just need to remind you that Radio Liberty is listener-supported. We're trying to get people to understand we're involved in a spiritual battle. There really are dark spirits or forces with an intense hatred of mankind that will turn human being against human being, white against black, black against Hispanic, Hispanic against white. It's all part, they promote wars and revolutions. And if you haven't seen my video, the Iraq, the Untold Story, or got our syllabus, it simply outlines all of the wars of the last century. They were all contrived, every single one of them, including the current one. And we even take the material from their website. Who are they? The Project for the New American Century. Their new website is newamericancensory.org, and you'll find out who they are. Back in 1997, they planned the war in Iraq. Who were they? Well, you go to their website and find out. Don Rumsfeld, Dick Cheney, Paul Wolfowitz, John Bolton, Elliot Abrams, Liberty. There were only 25 of them. 17 of them came from the Council on Foreign Relations. And, of course, they were laying out the plan that has brought us to where we are today. In the Middle East, which I look at not only from a geopolitical but from a spiritual point of view, and I believe we're moving into World War III, perhaps into what is prophesied in Ezekiel 38, and Ezekiel 39. Under any circumstances, we hope that many of you will go to our website at RadioLiberty.com, where you'll listen to our programs, and you'll tell others about our evening program here. You'll tell them about our website. If you'd like to get the four-tape set on O.J. Simpson, I think it's one of the most interesting ones we have, and of course it's available if you'd like more information, 1-800-544-8927. If you'd like a free copy of our newsletter, we'd be more than happy to send you out one. We hope that many of you may give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters, which is how we're able to do what we do 5 hours every day and reaching out to over 60 stations every week. And this is 60 outlets every week because some of them are internet or some of them are shortwave or satellites. But we do have a unique opportunity to reach people with the information you're never going to get from the controlled media. And so if you agree with me that we are involved in a spiritual battle being fought on a political and ideological and cultural, financial, educational battlefield, and you'd like to become part of our team trying to educate people how this all fits together. Because once you understand the spiritual component of it, then it all makes sense. If you look at it from purely geopolitical or historical, you get nothing but confusion. So if you believe there's a problem, if you have read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, why you understand what's going on. If you haven't read that book, Brotherhood of Darkness, which will give you an overview of the secret societies that exist today. And there are many secret societies. At least the hierarchy of these are secret. You may know about, of course, the front organization, but what energizes it? Where did the Council on Foreign Relations come from? We all hear about the CFR today, but did anybody tell you it was a front for a secret society that was created by Cecil Rhodes back in 1891, and we have the documentation on that by people who attended the meetings when they founded the secret society, and they were thrown out and admitted what was about. Well, we're out of time. Remember our number, 1-800-544-8927. Please pray for America, pray for revival, and pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty. For our provision and protection until Monday, may the Lord be with you. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And of course, we ordinarily invite your calls here at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or at 464-8295 in the Central Coast of California. But let's just hold our calls for the time being, because I think that you're going to learn a great deal from what Dave Emery says. Now, we're not going to agree on everything, but I think we can both see exactly the same things. We've never talked about this before, but Dave has done a great deal of studying. I've done a little bit of studying. And, of course, we've come to the same conclusion. That this was being used for entirely different purposes. And Dave says he thinks that the OJ operation was a psychops operation. That's a psychological operation done by our intelligence agencies. I believe it was. I believe it created even deeper, barrier between black and white in America. On one hand, they say, oh, we've got to integrate. On the other hand, they do everything they can to create suspicion and to drive us apart. And, of course, to relegate, tragically, the blacks of our country into second-rate citizens. And this all goes along with the eugenic ideas of the Aryans, Aryan nation, the elitists, the theosophists, the secret societies, the followers of Madame Blavatsky and the Rosicrucians, and, yes, even the Masons, that, of course, the white Anglo-Saxons are the pure race, the blacks are inferior, and we'd be better off without them. Tragically, there are people who really do feel that way. We saw that in Adolf Hitler's Germany. Tragically, we see this in America today. And I believe every individual is a unique individual made in the image and likeness of God, whatever the color of their skin is, why each person is important. And it's important to God. With that as the background, let's let Dave go ahead and pick up the story. Go ahead, Dave.
All righty. Well, thanks so much, Dr. Stan. And again, it's very exciting to appear on your program, because we've never spoken about the OJ case. I broached to one of your production assistants that this is something we might talk about, but we've never communicated about this. And yet, you said your four-tape series, and it just, you've interviewed a lot of the authors that I've interviewed, and a number of them. I mean, people have never heard of them. And when you talk about some of the information they presented, I've had people treat me like I just stepped out of a UFO. I mean, they absolutely, not only don't believe you, but they look at you like you're nuts. And yet, if one stops to think about what actually took place, it could not have taken place, and the way it was supposed to have. And I believe in the white supremacist hypothesis, but I also believe in the intelligence services. They're not mutually exclusive. There is an underground state within our country that is absolutely evil and that is completely opposed to the values America is dedicated to, and I think it is working to subvert this country, to subvert its traditional values, and to bring about something truly evil and unholy. And I think the OJ case was a major element in that. Now, let's go, by the way, before we get to the OJ case, let me remind listeners in the Monterey Bay area that I will be speaking tomorrow evening at 7 p.m. in the Loudon Nelson Community Center on Center Street in Santa Cruz. The subject is going to be one of the other really incendiary topics. That's the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And that, and the O.J. case. In 25 years on the air, Dr. Stan, I've never seen any topics in which people are so bitterly polarized about. It's a difficult thing to talk about. But I'm going to be talking about the Israeli-Palestinian question, and I think I'll be presenting a viewpoint that a lot of people will find different and hopefully refreshing and informative. Also, the landmark text, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, is going to be available from the late heroic Paul Manning. Paul Manning was one of the great reporters in American history. He had his career destroyed because he investigated this underground Reich. I got to know the family. And in my last communication with them, they indicated they'd like to see the book up on the Internet. It's now up on the Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com. But for people that can't download that for free from the website, it will be available for a nominal fee at the talk tomorrow night. Again, that's 7 p.m., Loudon-Nelson Community Center, 301 Center Street in Santa Cruz. And there are details on the Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com. That's S-P-I-T-F-I-R-E-L-I-S-T.com. Now back to the O.J. case, Dr. Stan. And once again, I'm going to encourage listeners to get that four-tape set that you have put together. I haven't heard the set, but I am familiar with a lot of the authors, and it's just refreshing because, you know, there are things that you and I disagree about, and yet to such an extent we're on the same wavelength, coming from somewhat different positions, but it's just great to be able to find a forum where I can talk about the O.J. case, the fact that he, not only didn't he do it, but that physically he could not have done it, and that this was a horrible thing that was put together by some very powerful forces. And then, you know, you're just right there, Johnny on the spot with the tapes and the interviews. I'm particularly impressed that you have an interview with Stephen Singular, because he's somebody that just did a great job on this case. His book has been suppressed. His career was destroyed because of that. And
you see, but there had to be another force behind it, you know, to destroy his career. So this was not simply because he put out a book on O.J., but this case was very, very important to somebody, far more rather than did O.J. kill his wife or not. But there, obviously, when you destroy somebody's career through an organized, orchestrated effort, you have to realize that what they were writing about had nothing at all to do with O.J. Simpson.
Oh, absolutely. I believe it was a psyop, and I believe that there were white supremacist elements involved. I think there were elements of the intelligence community involved. And the whole case also occurs against a background of organized vice, so to speak, as Donald Freed put it in his book, Killing Time. He's one of the authors that you interviewed, right, for your fourth
series. Right, it's a fascinating timeline.
Oh, is it called Timeline? Because it was originally called Killing Time.
Maybe it was Kill Time. Okay.
That's right, okay. It may have been re-released under a different title, but it was originally called Killing Time, and he also had a co-author whose name I forget off the top of my head, but Donald Freed is a wonderful guy, great researcher, also very well-spoken, too. He's a professor down at the University of Southern California, and he did a wonderful job. But I strongly encourage listeners who might be healthily skeptical about some of the things we're saying, get a hold of those four tapes that Dr. Stan has, because once again, it's another home run for Dr. Stan as far as I'm concerned, because it's unprecedented for me to appear in a forum as a guest, and the people know about these books, they know about these authors, they've interviewed them, and instead of having to scale the cliffs and take the enemy gun positions like the Rangers on D-Day, I can stretch forth and I find a welcome landing zone, so to speak, and it's really refreshing. Let's talk about the cop who was in charge of the crime scene, Dr. Stan. You know who was running the crime scene?
I really don't. It's been some while since it's been, almost 10 years now since that took place.
Well, this didn't get a lot of publicity. It was a woman named Connie Dial. She was a female member of the LAPD. Her original name was Connie Malazzo. She has a very interesting background. She married an LAPD officer named John Dial, who had been a member of an elite LAPD intelligence unit called the Criminal Conspiracy Section. Now, the Criminal Conspiracy Section was covered in a book called The Glass House Tapes. It was put together by a guy named Lewis Tackwood with a bunch of investigators, including, by the way, Donald Freed, and also the late Mae Brussel, with whom you're familiar, and who was a good friend of mine and one of the people who inspired me to do what I do. But Lewis Tackwood was an LAPD informant and agent provocateur. He worked with this Criminal Conspiracy Section in the late 60s and early 70s. And what the CCS was, basically, was an elite LAPD intelligence unit that functioned all over the state of California and even outside of the state of California, it served as something of a proxy, kind of a cat's paw, for elements of the FBI and the CIA. And what they did was they didn't investigate criminal conspiracies, they hatched criminal conspiracies. They set up elements of the African-American movement, both the Black Power movement and more moderate civil rights elements for crimes. They were involved with helping destroy the Chicano movement. They were involved with infiltrating the anti-Vietnam War movement and causing provocations there. The most heinous scheme that the CCS was involved with was something called the San Diego Conspiracy. What that involved was the a plan to, but originally in 1972, the Republican Convention was going to be in San Diego, and what they were going to do was infiltrate a bunch of operatives into the Republican Convention and blow it up, hopefully killing the President of the United States, then Richard Nixon. This was going to be blamed on anti-Vietnam War radicals and Black Power zealots, and it was going to be used as an excuse for declaring martial law and suspending the Constitution and also postponing the election. Lewis Tackwood passed a polygraph examination on this, and basically it was confirmed. Powerful journalists who were working on the side of light in this case for the Washington Post and Christian Science Monitor confirmed that, in fact, the case was accurate. Newsweek confirmed it. But then the story, as is so often the case, just died. Well, anyway, John Dial had been a key operative of the criminal conspiracy section, and Connie Milazzo, or the former Connie Milazzo, was an LAPD intelligence officer. She had previously worked in Italy for the Corriere della Sera. That's the largest Italian daily. It had strong connections with the Central Intelligence Agency, and she was working there in a time when there was a great deal of organized political violence in Italy, what Italians call the Years of Lead, or the Strategy of Tension. Many of the extreme left-wing terrorist groups, such as the Red Brigade, the Rosa Brigata, in Italy, had actually been put together by elements of the Propaganda Due Lodge, a Masonic lodge that actually functioned as sort of a crypto-fascist government in Italy. It was a repository for many of the elements that had supported Mussolini. It worked with the CIA. It has branches in Monaco, or had branches in Monaco, Argentina, Brazil, Uruguay. They even had a fellow named Philip Guarino, who was a member of the Republican Ethnic Outreach Organization. And Connie Milazzo worked with the Corriere della Sera during the Years of Lead. I suspect, and this is conjectural, but I suspect she may very well have been in the employ of the Central Intelligence Agency. Certainly her curriculum vitae is an unusual one. She goes from working for an American, an Italian-American working for a major Italian newsweekly, to becoming an operative with an elite intelligence unit of the Los Angeles Police Department. And she married John Dial, who was one of the criminal conspiracy section officers. So that in charge of the crime scene, by the way, the crime scene was opened up to reporters before the Goldman family was even notified in this case. That is one of the very, very interesting aspects of the O.J. Simpson case, because you have this very interesting woman literally connected by marriage, and perhaps by more than that, to an elite LAPD intelligence unit that works with elements of FBI and CIA, that had been involved in hatching criminal conspiracies in the past, and that was involved with hatching criminal conspiracies against African Americans. Another aspect of the O.J. case that bears mention, that is the extent to which the entire milieu cut across organized vice, so to speak, a milieu of organized crime, prostitution, gambling, sports betting, drugs, all kinds of things. One of the most interesting aspects of the O.J., well, there were a lot of interesting aspects, and again, we're talking about the media control of this, and listeners should stop and think how much of what I'm about to relate ever got out to the general public. Cutting across the entire O.J. case is a vein, so to speak, if one thinks about ore in a mine, of organized crime against sports betting, prostitution for both heterosexuals and homosexuals, drug trafficking, pornography, you name it. It was a talk show host here in the Bay Area, Dr. Stan, named Dwight Garrett, Dwayne Garrett was his name. He was a host on KGO, major AM talk station up in San Francisco. He also had been very active in the sports memorabilia business. And a few days after the killings, Dwayne Garrett said that Edward J. DeBartolo, the owner of the San Francisco 49ers, widely alleged, along with his father, to be involved with organized crime, had made an offer to O.J. to become the first black NFL franchise owner, but that O.J. had tried to back out because of the organized crime connections. Well, Dwayne Garrett then started getting death threats, and about a year later, he went off the Golden Gate Bridge and alleged suicide, despite the fact that people who knew him said he didn't seem depressed. He was quite a large man in girth, and a group of Japanese tourists at the base of the Golden Gate Bridge said they didn't see anybody fall, despite the fact that he was a large man and would have made a pretty big splash. So make of that what you will. The Buffalo News, by the way, that organized crime is deeply involved with professional sports. This is something a lot of people are very resistant to, but just look at your daily paper. Look at the sports section. Look, particularly during football week, during the football season, the betting lines for the National Football League games are listed in the paper all week long. Well, the sports book, sports betting, is run by organized crime. You don't have to be, I think, a Sherlock Holmes to figure out what's going on. In the Buffalo News, shortly after the killings, there was a story published that O.J. had allegedly been involved with some Buffalo area organized crime figures. Specifically, one of them was a fellow named Militello, and another was a fellow named Casimir Butch Casey Susharsky. And shortly after, about 2 weeks afterward, Kaz Susharsky was found murdered in Florida, just butchered, very much like Ron and Nicole, sliced to ribbons. I guess some women who were with him were also murdered. It is widely alleged, in fact, this is discussed in the book Killing Time by Donald Freed, that the Mezzaluna restaurant that had been frequented by both Nicole and her sister, and at which they had dined the night of the killings, was actually a front. Now, again, I can't confirm this, but it's alleged in the book Killing Time that it was a front for organized crime. Ron Goldman worked there as a waiter, and it is alleged in the book Killing Time that Ron Goldman, who, by the way, was $100,000 in debt at the time of his death, which that's a lot of money. I've waited on tables, and I've worked in the restaurant business. You don't usually come into that kind of dough, even in terms of lending. But he was $100,000 in debt at the time of his death. He was allegedly running drugs and acting as a gay prostitute and acting in gay porno films out of the Mezzaluna.
Now, this is alleged. Now, there's no, you're not saying this actually. This is alleged that this has happened.
Yeah, this is, Donald Freed does not name his sources. That's why I'm using the term alleged, because, you know, we have to cover ourselves in terms of litigation. But the allegations are made. It's hinted very directly in the book Killing Time. There are also other books that have made similar allegations. What is a matter, of course, is that Ron Goldman was gay. He was openly gay and had been all but disowned by his homophobic father, Fred, because of that. Freed and his co-author also alleged...
No, did Freed make this remark?
Yes, this is in Killing Time. Other people who've known Ron Goldman have made similar allegations. And again, I'm using the term alleged just to cover ourselves from a legal standpoint here. It was also alleged in Killing Time that Ron Goldman was getting death threats from his pathologically jealous gay lover. The manager of the Mezzaluna, again, alleged, hinted at very directly in the book Killing Time to have been an organized crime front, was managed by a guy named Keith Zlomcewicz. Now, Keith Zlomcewicz was one of Nicole's lovers. And in fact, what it is, as one begins to deconstruct the official version of the story, the superficial version that people basically assumed was that Ron Goldman was seeing Nicole romantically, that O.J. was jealous, and he killed Ron Goldman. Well, Ron Goldman was gay and was not interested in Nicole. Interestingly enough, O.J., even though he was a champion athlete, he was badly injured when he played football, and is now has very severe arthritis. If you watch him hitting a golf ball, he doesn't even use his legs when he swings. It's sort of amazing that he scores as well as he does, because he really can't use his legs to any extent. So that when people are assessing what happened as an event, they're thinking of O.J. Simpson, the champion football player. But this is O.J. Simpson a couple of decades or more later, when the effects of the brutal treatment that a football player receives begin to have an effect. And the O.J. Simpson's arthritis was so severe that in an exercise video that was introduced by the prosecution to show that O.J. was still in good shape, upon cross-examination, it was revealed that his arthritis was so severe that in the outtakes in the video, when he was doing jumping jacks, he couldn't raise his arms above his head. Nicole and Ron are both strong, athletic young adults with martial arts training, which is something to think about. Ron was a tennis instructor, too. They have fast reflexes and very strong forearms and hands. And we're going to continue, because I hear the music coming up there, we're going to continue with our discussions of some of the things we weren't told and all of the organized crime connections to this, because one of the things we were told is that O.J. was a pathologically jealous ex-husband, and when he saw Ron Goldman with his ex-wife, he killed Ron Goldman. Ron Goldman wasn't interested in Nicole, and we're going to listen to some evidence that would debunk fairly clearly the notion that he was jealous.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Dave Emery. We're talking about the Nicole Simpson killing O.J. Simpson. Was he guilty? Wasn't he? Well, pick up the story there, Dave.
Well, now, Keith Slomsiewicz, again, who was the manager of the Mezzaluna restaurant, alleged in Killing Time and other books to have been an organized crime front, was a former boyfriend of Nicole's. Now, the prosecution in the O.J. case maintained that O.J. was a pathologically jealous ex-husband and that he killed Ron because he was jealous of his attention to his ex-wife. Well, again, Ron Goldman was gay and was not at all interested in Nicole for sexual reasons.
He was allegedly gay, so...
Allegedly gay. Right. That's been sort of well-established, but let's be kind to the dead. He's allegedly gay. An interesting guy, there was a divorce lawyer I spoke to who said that as soon as he heard Chris Darden's opening presentation of the criminal case, he knew there was BS, where he said that O.J. had determined if he couldn't have Nicole, nobody could. Well, this guy's a divorce lawyer, and he said in a case where you get a wealthy ex-husband and his ex-wife, there's nothing that wealthy ex-husband wants more than for his ex-wife to take up with a new man, because that would save him a whole lot of money. He said from that point forward, he knew this was BS. But now let's go into the hypothesis of O.J. Simpson, the pathologically jealous ex-husband. When Nicole was getting written and telephone death threats, including sexually explicit death threats, she was frightened. She asked O.J. and Al Cowlings to come around her home. Nicole wasn't living in fear of O.J. In fact, she was afraid of somebody else. She had a pizza party, as reported in Killing Time. She had a pizza party at O.J.'s 3 weeks before the killing. She'd been very sick. She is alleged to have had a serious drug problem, had some health problems stemming from that. She was a drinker, and she got very sick. O.J. cared for her, but she not only wasn't living in fear of O.J., she asked O.J. and Al Cowlings to come around because she was getting threats from parties unknown. One of the evenings, when O.J. came around to make sure she was okay, the front door was open, and Nicole was having oral sex with...
But I think we should be a little careful in some of the things we say for the audience.
Well, this came out in the criminal trial.
I know it did, but for our radio audience, let's put that she was having relations with somebody.
Okay, all right. She was having sexual relations with Keith Slomsiewicz, which again I exceed to your guidelines there, as Dr. Stan. But this actually came out in the criminal trial. And basically, O.J. said to Nicole, he said, listen, not in the house with the kids upstairs. You know, he was angry about her lack of discretion. But he later, you know, shook Keith Slomsiewicz's hand, said there were no hard feelings or anything. Those aren't the actions of a man who's pathologically jealous. On the contrary. One of the cases that overlaps the O.J. case, and again, I'll follow your lead on this, Dr. Stan, because this does get into some areas that are sort of dicey.
Well, just a skim over them very superficially.
Okay.
Because I think the details aren't as important as the overall theme.
No, but let's go into one of the cases that overlaps the O.J. case in a big way, and that is the Heidi Fleiss case, the Hollywood Madam. It got a lot of publicity. But what did not get a lot of publicity was the fact that this case overlaps the O.J. investigation in many respects. People will remember the famous 911 call where Nicole called 911 and O.J. was supposedly breaking down the front door. Well, O.J. wasn't breaking down the front door. He didn't even realize Nicole was on the phone to the police. This came out under cross-examination in the criminal case, but was never reported by the news media.
Hold that thought right there. Okay, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and of course our guest this evening is Dave Emery, and we're talking about the at one point in the trial why it was brought out that supposedly O.J. Simpson was breaking down the door because Nicole Simpson was on the telephone calling the police complaining of domestic abuse. Pick up the story from there, Dave.
What it came out during the criminal case. During cross-examination, but again, never reported by the media, that what that argument was actually about was this. Nicole had been socializing with some of Heidi Fleiss's girls, basically a high-priced Hollywood call girl ring, and had been bringing them over to the house for social activities. And O.J. was angry about this, and what that fight was about was he was angry at his wife. He said he didn't want his kids growing up around prostitutes, something I can understand. But that was what that argument was about. It had nothing to do with him breaking down the door, threatening Nicole, or anything else, but he was very, very upset about that, and I can understand that. But that did not come out. Now, in the investigation of the Heidi Fleiss case, first of all, one of the people alleged to have been involved with Heidi Fleiss's girls, according to some of the girls that wrote memos.
Now, for our listeners out there, Heidi Fleiss was a very high-level madam in the Los Angeles area, and, of course, she had among her a clientele of some of the most prominent people and politicians in Los Angeles, and she would never reveal their names. In fact, she was sent to prison. She could have reduced her sentence if she had given their names, but she never would. She respected their privacy, and so she was sent to prison for a time and then eventually released. But she was probably the highest-priced madam in the Los Angeles area. Pick up the story there.
Right, and Nicole, and this was not disputed, had been socializing with some of Heidi Fleiss's girls, or women, anyway, her ladies. And O.J., that's what that 911 call was about. He was angry about that. Now, among the people who can be credibly reported to have been customers of Heidi Fleiss's call girl ring, among them was Keith Zlomcewicz, the manager of the Mezzaluna, whom O.J. had viewed having relations with his wife. Another of the names that cropped up in connection with the Heidi Fleiss case, and again alleged by the girls to have been a frequent customer, was Marcus Allen. Marcus Allen was also a Heisman Trophy-winning football player and star running back from USC. He was a good friend of O.J.'s, and recall that he also had been dating Nicole for a while after O.J. After O.J.'s divorce. The thing that was interesting about that is that Marcus Allen was a married man, and recall in that note that O.J. had written, one of the things he had cryptically warned about, he said, "Marcus, you know, you've got a good woman, you know, don't mess that relationship up." I can't remember the exact words, but that basically was what he was referring to. Another of the names that cropped up in connection with Heidi Fleiss's girls was the name of Adnan Khashoggi, the Saudi Arabian weapons dealer who was one of the main people in the Iran-Contra affair. His name also cropped up in connection with the Heidi Fleiss case. The Heidi Fleiss case overlaps another aspect of the O.J. case, which there is a very elite series of cruises that visit the Channel Islands, and one of the islands where these cruise ships visit is Turnberry Island, and this once again overlaps the world of big Hollywood money, drugs, organized vice, things of that kind, and one of the cases that overlaps the Heidi Fleiss case and the Turnberry Island cruise case is that of the monkey business. Now, that was a cruise ship that Gary Hart, who was being touted as the Democratic front runner, had been visiting, and then he had an illicit affair with Donna Rice on the monkey business, the appropriately named monkey business. That was the end of Gary Hart's candidacy. So the Turnberry Island cruise case and the Heidi Fleiss case, which overlap and which overlap the O.J. case, involve powerful people, political people, illicit activities, drug use, prostitution, things that could compromise the life of a public person. there were a number of very interesting deaths, too, in connection with the O.J. case. A man named Michael Nigg, who was a waiter along with Ron Goldman at the Mezzaluna, was murdered a couple of days before the killing. It turned out he was a defense witness. Now, it was brought out that he was killed in the papers, but it said there was no connection to the case, even though he was a former co-worker of Ron Goldman's. In fact, he was a defense witness, but he was murdered 2 days before he was to testify.
He was going to testify in the O.J. Simpson trial, you mean?
Yes, and he was a defense witness. He was going to testify for O.J.'s defense, but he was murdered 2 days before he was going to give testimony. There are a number of other very interesting evidentiary tributaries running in the direction of organized crime. Denise Brown, her sister, during the course of the case, was dating a guy named Tony Fiato, a.k.a. Tony Rome, a.k.a. Tony the Animal, a former mob enforcer turned federal informant. Fred Goldman...
Hold that thought right there. We're going to be back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and of course our guest this evening is Dave Emery. We're talking about the O.J. Simpson trial, and Dave has, of course, a tremendous wealth of information, as he always does, on many of the details of this case, and of course tying in the Heidi Fleischman trial to the O.J. Simpson trial, and the strange death of one of the waiters who is going to testify in favor of O.J., and he dies a couple of days before he is to testify. And ladies and gentlemen, I hate to say this, but you'd be amazed how often this happens. I've known a number of people since I've been active in this movement who've died. Authors have died under very strange circumstances. Investigators who've died under very strange circumstances. I've talked to at least three CIA assassins, people who were hired by the CIA, employed by the CIA to murder people. And this is not something that happened in the distant past, but in recent years. So with that as the background, go ahead and pick up the story.
Indeed. There are a lot of very interesting aspects to the case. There is a book that was published by an author in Sweden that alleges, now again I have to use allege, I can't confirm this, but alleges that Fred Goldman was also involved with laundering money for cocaine syndicates. What is a matter of public record is that his wife, Patty Goldman, was the ex-wife of a guy named Marvin Glass, who was a Chicago area narco attorney. He represented major drug traffickers and also laundered money. Marvin Glass was convicted of solicitation of murder, was sentenced to prison, and died of a fast-acting case of AIDS, after which his wife married Fred Goldman and became Patty Goldman, and she was sitting dutifully at his side during the course of the case, both criminal and civil case. Well, Patty Goldman had a lot of experience sitting in courtrooms. She'd spent quite a bit of time in courtrooms when her husband, the former ex-husband, the former drug money launderer and narco attorney Marvin Glass, was in court, and he spent a lot of time there. There are a lot of connections like that, and the corruption of the evidence, the corruption of the judicial process itself is really, really scary. One of the things in the civil case that got very little publicity, but when photographs were introduced of O.J. Simpson supposedly wearing these Bruno Mali shoes, not only were many of the photographs verifiably forged pictures, people recall the picture that ran in the National Enquirer of O.J. walking along the sidelines of the game, supposedly wearing Bruno Mali shoes. Well, if you take a look at that picture, if you can find a copy of it, notice how short O.J.'s legs are. One of the things that made O.J. such a great running back is he had very long legs, and when he broke out...
Hold that thought right there. Well, our guest is, of course, Dave Emery. We're talking about the O.J. Simpson case. Very important, because if you can understand that they manipulated our reality at that time, What are they manipulating now? And of course, Dave was just talking about the civil case. And of course, OJ won the criminal case, then he was charged civilly. And of course, one of the things was the shoes that he was wearing. What were the name of those shoes?
The Bruno Mali shoes.
Bruno Mali shoes. Now, the thing is, didn't anybody question the fact that you can do anything you want to with photography? I mean, I can see these pictures on the screen. I can see, the fish flying. I can see all sorts of things on the screen. We see these dinosaurs in Jurassic Park, and those aren't real dinosaurs. They don't exist today, but they certainly look like real dinosaurs. So they can do anything with films today. Didn't the defense challenge the authenticity of these pictures?
Well, this gets into one of the most alarming aspects of the O.J. Simpson case, Dr. Stan, and that is the corruption of criminal law. Not only that, but the establishment of legal precedent for what will be just an absolute nightmare totalitarian regime. There was a photographic expert named Robert Grodin, who, by the way, did a lot of good work on the JFK assassination, exposing some of the forged photographs that were used to justify the Warren Report. And he proved that basically the famous picture of O.J. walking along the sidelines was a forged picture. Now, if you ever get a chance to look at that famous National Enquirer photo, I think it was on the cover of the National Enquirer, bearing in mind that the publisher, the guy who founded the National Enquirer, Generoso Pope, was a former CIA psychological warfare officer. People I know with intelligence backgrounds flat out allege that it is a CIA publication to this day, basically what they call a propaganda asset. But one of the things that made O.J. such a great running back was that he had long legs, so when he broke into the clear, he could get his very long stride, which put him ahead of the pack. But if you look at that picture, he's got these tiny little legs, and the top half of his body is larger than his legs, and that just wasn't the case. But the scariest thing is that when the photographs of O.J. supposedly wearing Bruno Mali shoes were introduced by Mr. Petrocelli, who was the lead attorney for the plaintiffs in the civil case, they were the judge in that case ruled that O.J.'s defense team could not examine most of the photographs. Some of those photographs showed O.J. wearing what were purported to be gray Bruno Mali shoes. Well, Bruno Mali never made a gray shoe. These were something else. They were hush puppies, something else, doctored shoes. But the point is that these were introduced into evidence against O.J. Simpson, showing him supposedly wearing gray Bruno Mali shoes, and Bruno Mali has never made a gray shoe. Well, how could that happen? It happened because the judge in the O.J. Simpson civil case would not allow O.J.'s counsel to examine the evidence against their client. That is extraordinary. And I asked an attorney of my acquaintance, I said, how readily, just bear in mind, again, as you know, Dr. Stan, law is built on a body of precedent. When a group of attorneys, an appellate court, whatever, goes to rule, they study the legal precedent in such a case. And I asked an attorney how readily a judgment or a verdict, a principle of law from a civil case could extend over into the criminal realm, and he said very readily. That happens quite often. So here with the O.J. case, a lot of white people thought, yeah, we'll get that N-word, we'll get him, that brute who murdered his wife. Well, there is now, in the United States of America, legal precedent for evidence being introduced against someone in a court of law and their defense counsel being barred from examining the evidence against their client, and that stems from the O.J. Simpson case. But there were other things as well. There was a law passed almost in secret by the California legislature, and I think this was in the summer of 1996, to allow Nicole's diary into evidence in the civil case. Well, first of all, although there are a number of exceptions to the hearsay evidence rule, that took place almost, there was very little reportage of that. Oddly enough, Geraldo Rivera was one of the very few people to report that, and he was very much opposed to O.J., but that law basically admitted into evidence a book which was not really a diary. That book was a thought journal that Nicole had been keeping for her psychotherapist, and it included her dreams, her fantasies, her fears. This wasn't even a diary. So what you had with the O.J. Simpson case and the civil case, you had the California State Legislature passing a law almost in secret to allow a document which involves the dreams, fantasies, and fears of a deceased woman into evidence against her ex-husband. And people in the listening audience should just stop and consider about how they would like their ex-spouse's dreams and fantasies introduced into evidence in a court of law against them. That is very, very scary indeed, but that was accomplished through a specific bill passed by the California State Legislature. In the civil case, after the verdict awarding damages to the plaintiffs in the case came out, Greta Van Susteren of CNN had an interview with Daniel Petrocelli. Somebody else who interviewed Daniel Petrocelli, the lead attorney for the plaintiffs, and he was saying how much he enjoyed his weekly breakfast with Greta Van Susteren of CNN, who got a lot of publicity off of that coverage. Well, there was a gag order in this case. All of the people involved, defendants, plaintiffs, and attorneys for both sides were barred by judicial ruling from speaking with the press. That, in and of itself, that interview that Daniel Petrocelli gave should have been cause for a mistrial. There was a gag order in the case. But here he is on national TV talking about how much he enjoyed his breakfasts with Greta Van Susteren. That is a travesty. And that's an indication of some of the precedents that were established in the O.J. case. As I mentioned early on in the first hour, Dr. Stan, I'm not as worried as some people about the passage of the Patriot Act. Certainly, there are some very dangerous things in there, but in many ways, people who are concerned with civil liberties, and they should be, have missed the boat. The horse is long gone from the barn. They can close the doors now, but the horse is galloping away. I've been warning people who are concerned with the issues of privacy and civil liberties. I'm saying that things long ago were way beyond the point of control. People get worried about, well, is the government going to be, tapping my phone or whatever? And, it's legitimate, but they think nothing about submitting to drug testing at work. And when a person submits a urine sample, as you know, Dr. Stan, you're a doctor, there's DNA in there. And that then becomes the property, not just of their employer, but of a possible employer. And they have no control over what happens with that sample. So basically, they're just giving away their DNA to a complete stranger. And this has been something that's been more or less standard procedure for many years. I think for some professions, such as people operating, railroads or pilots or something like that, sure, that's something that people have to have because these are safety related. But there's a very, very, very strong issue, privacy and civil liberties involved in something like that. But people who got alarmed over the passage of the Patriot Act, and I can understand that. But nobody got alarmed over the O.J. Simpson case, and they bloody well should have gotten alarmed over that, because now, as a result of the legal precedents established in the O.J. Simpson case, your ex-spouse's dreams and fantasies can be introduced into a court of law against you, and your defense attorney can be barred from examining evidence against you, against his client or her client.
Well, I've always felt that the civil trial was a setup. They were intent upon getting O.J., and they were willing to twist the law. They were willing to allow perjured testimony. It really didn't matter. They were going to get him. They were going to get his Heisman Trophy. They were going to break him, and they did.
They did indeed.
And the only thing is that I'm so glad he got off. And I think, though, that what this has done is simply accomplished exactly what it wanted to, create tremendous racial discord. One of the, somebody had called in and asked a question, well, if he was innocent, why was he running away from the police, in the white Bronco? And, of course, that is what we see over and over and over and over ad nauseum. This chase. Well, it wasn't a chase. I mean, the car was driving very slowly, and I think that the O.J. was panicked. I think that he realized he was being set up. Mm-hmm. He realized they were out to get him because of a black man married to a white woman. That would be my impression, that he was even thinking possibly of committing suicide.
He was. I think that's one of the things he was considering, although Al Cowlings is the only person who talks about O.J. having had a gun to his head. And bear in mind that Al Cowlings, along with Robert Kardashian, O.J.'s friend, or quote friend, unquote, and former attorney who rolled over on O.J. late in the case, Robert Kardashian and Al Cowlings were being investigated by...
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.